Risky business. Business. Business.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Risky Business. I'm Patrick Gray. This edition of Risky Business is brought to you by Tenable Network Security, the makers of Nessus and all sorts of other very clever enterprise security software. You can find them at tenablesecurity.com, and I recommend that you do. There was no podcast last week. I was actually quite sick for a couple of days last week, and I was also really busy. Flew down to Sydney for an event that was held by F-Secure. I moderated a press conference panel for them, and I've podcasted the whole thing in Risky Business 2, which is our other podcast. And we've got a stack of other content coming out in Risky Business 2 over the next month. You'll hear more of Paul Craig's interviews and talks from ShuckerCon, the recorded talks that he did. And he's also recorded some more stuff from the OWASP Day that was just held in Auckland. So go to risky.biz and subscribe to that podcast. You can find the feed at risky.biz/feeds. Now, a couple of things before we get stuck into this week's show. This news item popped up after I'd recorded the news interview with this week's guest, who's Kimberly Zenz. Apparently in South Africa, a bank has fitted 11 of its ATMs across the Cape Peninsula with pepper spray to deter criminals from tampering with them. So if you try to attach a skimming device, bang, pepper spray right in the eye. So I wasn't able to independently verify this story, but it was all over Twitter and a couple of websites, like established news websites. And it's pretty funny, especially considering the report mentioned that the pepper spray actually accidentally discharged during a routine maintenance inspection, which I think is pretty damn hilarious. And I noted one of the comments on the news piece where I found it said they were really hoping to get sprayed because they'd love any excuse to sue a bank. So wonder if it's an approach we'll see here or in the US. Who knows? But interesting anyway. I like the way they roll in South Africa. Oh, another thing. Senator Stephen Conroy, who was a guest on the show a few weeks ago, has just been voted the Internet Villain of the Year at the 11th Annual Internet Industry Awards in the UK. So this guy is now globally recognised as a supervillain. And we had him on the show before he was cool. He even edged out Sarkozy from France to actually get this prize. So he's a complete global badass. But back to more serious things that we've got to concern ourselves with. And on this week's show, we'll be joined by our semi-regular guest, Adam Poynton. Adam is the chief security officer for a financial services company. So he's got a fair bit of insight into both security technology and market-based technology. Now, many of you would have heard by now that the investment bank Goldman Sachs has claimed its trading algorithm has been stolen by one of its developers. So why is that a big deal? How would the possession of that algorithm be advantageous to an attacker or a competitor? We thought we'd ask Adam to shine a little bit of light on that one for us, and that one's coming up soon. We'll also hear from Brian Jericho Martin. He is the maintainer of the open source vulnerability database, and he also works for Tenable Network Security, our sponsor. So he'll be along in this week's sponsor interview to have a chat about that nasty DirectX bug, or the Direct Show bug that's doing the rounds at the moment. Did Microsoft drop the ball on that one? Well, the answer is a maybe, as you will hear later on. Now, normally we'd throw to our regular news guest, Adam Boileau, at this point, but this week we've got a special guest with whom we will discuss the week's big events, iDefence cybercrime analyst Kimberly Zenz, who was in Australia for a cybercrime conference in Queensland. I caught up with Kim with a list of the week's news stories and recorded this interview. Kimberly, we just heard in this at this cybercrime conference in Queensland that you were at, that apparently a scam that's pretty popular in other parts of the world has found its way here to Australia, which is that that old trick of using people's stolen trading accounts to push around the value of microcap stocks.
Well, yes, essentially it's the traditional Trojans, but this time they're being used to get people to purchase stock without their knowledge.
Yeah, so what are they trying to do? They're trying to drive up the price of stock that they already hold, and then they dump it, and voila.
Exactly. I mean, that's as the name suggests, pump and dump. They try to get people to buy, traditionally through things like spam, a stock that they've decided to promote. They've already bought the price. They've already bought the stock. And then, you know, once the price goes up, they sell it. In this case, it just takes it one more level in as much that now they don't need to convince you to do anything. They could just make you do it with your account.
Well, I guess, yeah, the silver lining to this story is that police have apparently made an arrest and they're preparing to charge at least one individual. So that's kind of good, right?
Well, in this case, it is. Actually, it's really to their credit because it's pretty hard to follow these things because many of these Trojans don't come from the country where the crime commits. So good for them.
Yeah. According to Julian Bykowski, who broke the story, police are preparing to charge one individual, and a successful prosecution could create an important precedent for the burden of proof required by customers of financial services providers when online transactions are disputed. And I believe that's how this one came to light, is someone said, I did not buy those shares, those particular penny stocks. Now, moving on to the next story, and our mutual friend, Mark Dowd, in conjunction with our good little Kiwi buddy, Ben Hawkes, have just won some cash, some fat cash from Google for finding some vulnerabilities in their native client software. It looks like, him and Hawkes actually went through it. Now, the native client thing, we had Mark on the show a few weeks ago talking about this. It's it enables you to run native x86 code in the browser, which initially when you hear that, you think, gee, that's really not a good idea. But apparently, Mark has given it almost a pseudo thumbs up and said the security was pretty good, but he did still manage to find some bugs.
Hi, Mark. Congratulations. Well, what he said was that, you know, people do make mistakes and it is a flawed process, so he did find some errors, which is also the purpose of this contest. But nothing was too significant, and he thought ultimately it would be a pretty secure product.
Yeah, so congratulations to Mark, and also to Ben, who's a young tacker who's on his way up and up, more so after this, and I don't know, I guess, you know, we can hit these guys up for a beer next time we see him, because I think the prize money was something like 10 grand, I don't know.
It was substantial.
Yeah, so well done, boys, congratulations. Moving on, and CNET has a report up that says that social security numbers in the US, which are, of course, a little bit important to matters of identity, they can actually be guessed.
Well, yes, these researchers at the University of Carnegie Mellon figured out the patterns, because depending on where you're born and when you were born, that's how you get your social security number assigned. And the problem with these numbers in the US is they are essentially a national ID number. It is considered against the Constitution to do a real national ID, so they're used de facto for that purpose. And you use them for everything. Like, if you want to get a credit card, they'll ask you this. Like, they really use them for far more than the pension system.
So how reliably can someone actually guess the social security number?
Well, to guess the full numbers is actually pretty hard. I mean, the statistic that they said was they got the complete security numbers for less than 8.5% of the people, for 1,000 people. The real problem, though, is you don't need the full number. A lot of the credit rating services will take the birth data, which you can get in lots of places. It's pretty publicly available if you know where to look, and 5 digits. And so if you can just get the first ones, and those are the ones that are determined, you know, birthplace, a birth, time of birth, and all that. If you can get those, you can just start entering numbers, and you're going to get credit reports, at which point you're going to get a huge more amount of data on these people.
All right. Now, look, this next story, we've actually got Brian Martin coming on the show, and he's going to discuss it in a little bit more detail. But there's been some rumors going around of a vulnerability in SSH. And what I find funny about this story is there is, like, zero proof that this thing actually exists, but everybody's talking about it.
Well, if it's real, then it matters. But I actually think the more interesting case is how big of a deal it is, given that there is no proof.
Everybody's talking about this. So perhaps we shouldn't, because we're just encouraging the rumor mill. So, okay, we're going to move on. This story I picked out from Dark Reading just because the headline is actually quite hilarious, which is Google has disclosed plans for a new malware-resistant OS. I mean, what is a malware-resistant OS, really?
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, they're talking about putting it, you know, like online, and so that's going to remove it from the kind of traditional malicious code that targets traditional OSs, but it's just shifting the risk.
Yeah, so it's going to be like a cloud OS, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so it's just a different type of risk, and there will be new vulnerabilities that people will just target instead of the existing vulnerabilities.
So are we ready to say Google's full of shit?
No, I mean, anything helps. You know, you have to at least try. So there is definitely quite a huge risk as it comes to existing OSs. So if they can think of something that reduces it even temporarily, why not?
Hooray for everyone.
Yeah, exactly. And long term, maybe they'll be able to handle it better. But, you know, we'll see.
Well, moving on to an area that's more within your area of specialty. And look, it's fired up the headlines all over the world, which is these attacks on South Korea and the United States and all of this. What did they hit? They hit the White House website and stuff like that. These huge DDoS attacks. Fill us in on the basics.
Well, there's a huge list of targets, both in the U.S. and in South Korea. I mean, there are big government agencies like the White House, DHS, which is Homeland Security, Secret Service, which actually do a lot against cybercrime, as well as protect the president, The NSA, Trade Commission, Department of Defense, State Department, all the big ones, and then a couple of the major retailers as well.
Now, the commentariat seemed to have completely lost their minds, and everyone's sort of pointing towards North Korea and saying it's them, when some other security guys are saying this sort of botnet that's doing these DDoS attacks is well within the reach of the capability of a 15-year-old. So, which do you think it is?
I'll believe it's North Korea when I see something to suggest it's North Korea. At this point, it looks like it's an Asian botnet. That's where most of the bots are, and it is believable. And, you know, I think the North Korea hypothesis came a lot out of where the targets were, because they're in the U.S. and in South Korea. But there's really nothing to prove that it is. And it is a pretty decent-sized DDoS attack, but it's not in the realm of the impossible. I mean, if I wanted to do this, I could hire someone to do this for me.
One of your Russian friends.
Well, I wouldn't say friends, but Russia is known for having quite a serious market for DDoS attacks or higher, and it is not impossible to get them at all.
Okay, so you're not ready to point the finger and say this is state-sponsored?
No.
Well, I guess that moves on to our next story, which comes from Wired, which tells us that a key Republican has actually pointed the finger at North Korea. Now, he's gone out, I think it was on TV or radio, and in an interview and said that the United States government should immediately cyber attack North Korea. Now, to quote Donald Rumsfeld, of all people, I would imagine that North Korea in a cyber war wouldn't be a particularly target-rich environment.
No, I mean, within North Korea, there are sort of isolated areas of internet, but it is only for the privileged few. Most people do not have access to it. They don't really have a lot of vital resources online. If I truly wanted to hurt them, I'm not even sure what I would go after. The guy, I don't know, maybe his heart's in the right place, maybe he's just grandstanding, I don't know, we're not friends, but it sort of actually strikes me of a concern I have with some of the lawmakers, just because this is not something that they know a huge amount about, but they do have a lot of responsibility for handling the security, and so they base things on their, almost I want to say, gut reactions without much of an understanding.
Well, this is what I find interesting, is here you have a conservative politician in the United States who's obviously trying to do a bit of grandstanding and grab some sort of political leverage over a cyber attack. And that's the first time that I can think of that someone's really going after the U.S. government. Someone from the opposition is going after the U.S. government and saying, this will not stand, we must strike back. Do you think this sort of shows that the issue is really maturing and quite rapidly?
Well, I think it shows that it's definitely becoming more prominent. And there's a lot in the U.S. right now for talking about improving cybersecurity, and there's a lot of money as well. So he may just be going for contracts for his home state. I don't know. But oh no, it's huge what's going on in terms of that. But it's kind of interesting. He has something a bit in common with the Russians, and the U.S. criticized them quite strongly a few months ago. They suggested a plan and legislation within Russia that would say if Russia came under some sort of a cyber attack, it would be Russia who could determine who was responsible, and then they would be, by law, allowed to retaliate. And at the time, people were like, oh, the bad Russians are just being violent and unfair, and now this guy is doing the exact same thing.
Well, and I love the quotes here. He was speaking, I mean, this guy actually was the lead Republican on the House Intelligence Committee. And he actually said, during this interview, that the U.S. should conduct a show of force or strength against North Korea for a supposed role in the round of attacks. Now, speaking on the conservative America's Morning News radio show, which is produced by the Washington Times newspaper, he said that some of the best people in America had been investigating the attacks and concluded that most likely all the fingers point to North Korea as the culprit. Now, what I find funny about this is that is the direct opposite of what pretty much everyone is saying.
Absolutely. I have not talked to anyone in America who has said, oh yes, it's definitely North Korea. Not one person.
Have you spoken to anyone who's even suggested there is any evidence whatsoever to suggest that it's North Korea?
Beyond the circumstantial evidence of the actual targets, no.
Now, Adam Poynton is our next guest on the show, and he's going to be talking to us in detail about this apparent leak of data from Goldman Sachs. But just for the news listeners, can you fill us in on this story? Like, what's happened?
Okay, well, the whole thing started when an employee of Goldman Sachs, who is Russian, but I don't think that's much of a connection, was charged with trying to steal some of the Goldman Sachs proprietary trading software. And they got, you know, the Goldman Sachs got law enforcement involved pretty quickly. He was arrested. He's arguing that it was an accident. He, you know, he uploads stuff all the time, and it isn't what they said. That's going to be for the investigation to work out. The issue becomes where it appears that maybe Goldman Sachs was involved in some insider trading using this software, that they had access to other people's kind of placed trades just a second before they were actually placed. And Goldman Sachs, I mean, at some points, oh gosh, now I forget the statistic, but they were responsible for something like 60% of trades in some cases. I mean, they're huge.
Yeah, that's on the New York Stock Exchange. I believe the figure was something like, 50% of all trading volumes on the NYSE were placed by Goldman Sachs.
Yes, and so it's into that. And the issue that's also a bit of an issue is they've been posting gross profits on that of $100 million a day. And I don't know if you've noticed, but it's not the greatest economic environment in the U.S. at the moment, so that's a little bit suspicious.
But who has been alleging that these trades were perhaps illegally executed by Goldman Sachs? Who's alleging the insider stuff?
Well, at this point, no law enforcement officials, none of the investigators has come out and said this is what's going on. At this point, it's a combination of concern over Goldman's reaction and observers who are already watching these profits, which have now dropped significantly, which is also a little suspicious, just the timing.
So let me recap, right? So the algorithm's been stolen. Goldman has apparently just started shitting bricks.
Yes.
Because maybe it appears on the surface, some people are saying that perhaps they're worried that if the algorithm gets inspected by the authorities, they might find a few little nasties in the algorithm, which mean maybe they haven't been complying with rules.
Yes, which when you tie into their rather excellent performance of late is sort of kind of raising the conspiracy theory questions.
Well, this is going to be one to watch. Kimberly Zenz, thank you very much for joining us on Risky Business.
Well, thank you very much. It's always a pleasure.
Kimberly Zenz of iDefense there in the flesh. Thank you, Kim, for doing the week's news. Up next, it's time for our feature interview with Adam Poynton, the Chief Security Officer of a financial services company, which we will not name. I could tell you, but I'd have to kill you. Adam joins us now to discuss the alleged theft of Goldman Sachs' trading algorithm by a departing employee. You heard Kim and I discuss that. It looks like the guy was on the way out the door and might have accidentally tarballed up some of those very sensitive files. Now, Goldman has been jumping up and down about this. Adam, what are these trading algorithms usually used for? And would it be fair to say that they're a very closely guarded bit of intellectual property?
Definitely. What they basically do is optimize everything that goes through. So you'll have, there was a report saying that Goldman did 68% of all NYSE trades.
NYSE being New York Stock Exchange, right?
Correct, yeah. So 68% of the trades are going through Goldman as a broker. So they come from everywhere, little two-man bands or smaller brokerage houses to large market makers that go through them. And what they do is basically optimize transactions as they enter the market. So if there's conflicting transactions, they'll settle them pre-market or they'll basically optimize them so that as they go in, they'll get the best transaction or size or position size or price.
So if one of their clients is trying to sell StockX and the other one is trying to buy it, they can actually do that as an off-market transaction, for example?
Depends on what it is. A lot of it still will go to market. That would be separate if it's a market maker type thing or if it's an off-market transfer. But this was around their actual quantitative trading system. So this is all on market. But this was smaller broking firms that would go through and even large ones using Goldman upstream, basically. But what this code attempted to basically do is just optimize everything that as it goes through and enters the market so that they get the best sort of return and get the best position as it goes on. So it is a very tightly guarded secret about what they do to optimize it. It also looks at their analysis of cross the market and information and tries to take that on board when it makes their execution decisions on a pure algorithmic basis rather than human analysis.
Now, aside from the fact that this sort of algorithm would be obviously very useful to a stockbroker who was also a competing firm that was looking to do the same thing, is it possible that having an algorithm which controls 68% of the trades on a major stock exchange, would that give you any insight into the way Goldman executes its trade? And would that enable someone to perhaps preempt the way those trades are going to be done and make some money out of it? Is it possible?
There's basically a concept called front running is kind of, I guess, what you're alluding to, which is if you can get in front of the people that are making a decision and you're ahead of their decision, then you get, sort of caught as that boat rises. With this software and what it appears the software, where that software is positioned within Goldman, having access to it may be of value if you could determine what Goldman were to do. I think what this person did is they probably, they were obviously very involved in the development of it, so they knew the logic and they knew the business rules, but they actually wanted the software. So they went to go to another brokering firm, and they obviously...
Well, we should be careful and just say that's what's actually been alleged. The guy said he didn't even mean to transfer the code out of there, and it's all before the court, so we can't obviously preempt the outcome.
From what they said, you know, it actually encrypted itself. It went over a secure channel and it was carved up and whatnot. So, yeah, there's a few things that took place there for the code to get out.
Well, I noticed actually the reason they dinged him is because he was trying to delete his bash history.
There's a lot of speculation around that as well. They said they caught the HTTPS transfer out. It was some new system that they'd put in place to tap SSL on the way out, and they picked it up that way. Another report said it was, you know, encrypted and compressed and obfuscated and yada yada. So I'm not really sure, but I guess he was one of the primary authors of that code. So he actually apparently had a patent on a similar system in a previous life. So I think a whole lot more of information will come out around Goldman, just around where they sit. 68% of the market's a lot, going through this code that is now potentially in the public domain or in other private enterprises, obviously will affect the market as a whole as well as Goldman. I think they were saying, you know, $100 million a day
profit
from this trade.
Well, I suppose it's also because they have such, I mean, they're placing so many orders. So, I mean, just going back to this concept of front running, would you need to have further information than just the algorithm by itself? Or would that algorithm just on its own, if I gave it to you, for example, could you sit down there and do evil things with it and be able to preempt Goldman? Or would you need to know more about what their intended movements on the market would be?
I guess without seeing what was actually taken, you know, it'd be hard to comment on that. I think anybody could make everybody's looking for an edge. Having this doesn't suggest that you would get the 51% advantage and therefore, you know, 51% versus 49, then you'd win majority of the time and therefore it would be, more lucrative than not. But I guess with this sort of algorithmic trading, the closer to the wire that you are, the larger you are, the higher volume you are is where it actually counts. The decisions that they are going to make and you trying to execute at the same time as the decisions they are going to make doesn't necessarily mean that you'll win. It's not that simple. A lot of this is if you knew the logic that they were following to basically analyze and then better optimize their system. If you had a similar algorithm, and you put that into your same algorithmic trading system that was, you know, down to the wire speed and had volume through it already and all those sorts of things, then it would benefit you because you could guess what they were going to do with a closer approximation than guess, and therefore you could benefit. But you couldn't take this software and print it out and have a look at it and go, well, that means they're going to do X on the 14th of January. So I guess anybody wishing to kind of benefit or profit from this would be looking to work with them rather than against them or against them. But it wouldn't be, you wouldn't sort of take this, run it across a bunch of data and then say, well, therefore they're going to make this decision at this point in the future. It's a very now and then as it goes on the wire. So after that point, it's probably of little value.
Okay. Now, one of the interesting things that we've noticed emerging in media reports is Goldman jumping up and down and saying someone could use this algorithm to gain an unfair advantage over the market, which begs the obvious question, why the hell are they allowed to have it?
Yeah, I think a lot of that will actually come out in the future. I know there was a whole bunch of regulatory people sort of looking at it, will saying, well, you know, you're doing 68% and you're profiting from, you know, this throughput. You're jumping up and down saying somebody else could do it, yet you're doing it. So how is that not?
So, I mean, there could be, I mean, is one of the reasons they're worried that this algorithm might have jumped out into the pseudo public domain or at least out of their control, is one of the concerns that someone might actually have a look at it and see that they've been doing, shall we say, naughty things?
No, I don't believe so. Going from the report, it says that it was, you know, he basically helped lead a team who designed this algorithmic automated system. And, you know, my guess is he probably wanted to get, you know, what a lot of people out there is, from what I see, you know, from risk around staff is they want to get a competitive advantage over other staff who are in a tight labour market. So they're taking intellectual property, walking out the door, going to a new employer, and then using that intellectual property to star at their new employment place and be the key employee, rather than take the software, go to a new firm, sell it, and, you know, win and make lots of profit. I don't think that's what it is. I think it's more of a case of protecting his adding value to his own CV, but not with the actual code spelt out. Because it also begs the question, would you hire a person who's, you know, stealing IP from another company and coming across to yours? I mean, clearly he's going to steal yours.
Well, I mean, the way I'd do it, mate, is I'd steal the algorithm, and then once a day I'd cut and paste a page of code into the compiler and say, well, that's what I did today.
Well, that's exactly what I was saying. It's, you know, he becomes a star employee. But I think, you know, who knows where this is and who knows what this code actually is. Mm. It could have any number of ramifications around it. It's going to be interesting as it plays out, as it sort of is exposed, because I think Goldman are trying to really, you know, play it down as far as it being IP, and it's, you know, it's important to them as a business, but it doesn't affect the wider market. Let's just look over there and we'll continue on making $100 million a day. The key here is that, you know, whilst it's 32 meg of potentially very important, sensitive intellectual property of Goldman's, it's not something that somebody could just pick up and change the world with. They'd need to, it's all about getting that millisecond, that, you know, shaving of 1 cent advantage. So high volume with an existing system, it would probably help an algorithmic trader, but it's not going to help the average buy and sell mum and dad investor.
No, but I guess what I was getting at before is, if, you know, you were a brokerage firm and you could place trades nearly real time and you had this algorithm, it would give you an edge over Goldman. You would be able to know where Goldman were going, and that would be incredibly profitable, wouldn't it?
It could be, yeah. It'd give you an advantage over every other broker, not necessarily over Goldman, because they could quite easily change their algorithm.
Okay. So you're just going to be able to replicate their secret source?
Well, replicate their secret source at that point in time based on what you've got and the information that you're feeding this thing. So the algorithmic software that they've got, 32 meg of code, it's not going to predict the future. It still needs an input to get an output. So you'd still need good quality input rather than garbage in, to get a good outcome. But yes, it would help you as another competing brokerage firm in optimizing your transactions based on information Goldman have. So you could play in the field of what their decisions are, and arguably you could also, additionally to that, is profit from going with or against Goldman's decision.
Okay, well, Adam Poynton, thank you very much for walking us through the oh-so-confusing world of online trading algorithms. Thanks a lot for joining us.
No worries.
Adam Poynton there with a look at some alleged corporate espionage, possibly a very significant case of corporate espionage if it's all true, or it could just be nothing. Who knows? Anyway, it's time for this week's sponsor interview now with Brian Martin, the maintainer of the Open Source Vulnerability Database and Tenable Network Security's subject matter expert. That is actually his real job title with them. I got Brian on the line and asked him about this Direct Show Zero Day in Windows that has been doing the rounds. As it turns out, ISS had first reported this bug to Microsoft back in 2008. Brian, initially when it was disclosed that this bug was being exploited, it looked like it was really limited circulation. Has that actually changed?
Yeah, definitely. The initial report said that it was a new in-the-wild attack, that a handful of people or a small group were exploiting it. But within a couple of days, I think about 24 hours later, Microsoft released their knowledge base article. And one of the first things that stood out was that it already had a CVE identifier for 2008 with a really low number. And that usually means that it was assigned early 2008, even if it came from a larger pool of numbers. And it only took, hours or half a day after that for people to find out that it had indeed been sitting in Microsoft's hands for a year and a half and was originally disclosed by ISS during their research. So it kind of went back to the whole thing with the disclosure debate. How long can a vendor sit on something before they realistically believe that, you know, that it's safe to do that? This is pretty much proof that no matter what you think, given enough time, someone is going to find that exploit, and you're not going to be the only one with it.
Well, it is a very interesting little situation, really, because the security community over the last few years has really been praising Microsoft in general for its approach to fixing bugs. Do you think this was a mistake? Do you think someone perhaps misclassified this as a non-serious issue? Do you think someone dropped the ball? Was it a question of priority and resources? How do you think something like this would have happened?
Well, a lot of people have been giving praise to Microsoft. They absolutely have done better on their security response. They have a team dedicated to handling vulnerabilities. And after talking with a lot of them one-on-one, I personally believe that they have done better and that they have a lot better plan for addressing these. Since this is so far what appears to be a one-off issue, it's hard to say. There's a good chance that maybe they were under the impression that it was a low-end denial of service attack. But you would think that after a year and a half, they could have researched and figured out, hey, wait a minute. But on the other hand, ISS, they're not known for disclosing low-end denial of service attacks. They've got some brilliant researchers, and when they mail you something, there's a good chance that it's a serious issue. So maybe it fell through the cracks. Maybe there was some misunderstanding along the way. But the one thing that we can be sure of is that we hope this was a single incident where it was the drop ball, and that this isn't, you know, a foreshadowing of a lot more vulnerabilities to come.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, I really struggle to think of anyone when, you know, when people look at the model for how this sort of stuff should be done. These days, people tend to point at Microsoft and say, well, they do the really good job. I can't really think of another company that addresses these issues as well as them, which makes me wonder if it is possible for any software company to get it right 100% of the time. It really just is going to come down to a question of resources, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think basically if the company is over five people, it's going to become increasingly difficult to address bugs, and it's going to take a little longer each time. If it's a small enough company, they typically have the resources to immediately deal with it because it's still a small product, small code base. There's very few people involved in the process to fix a vulnerability. But when you get a company like a Microsoft or an Oracle, all of a sudden, one vulnerability represents hundreds of people involved. And that's when bureaucracy and red tape come in and slow down the process.
Oh, not to mention all the regression testing they've got to do to make sure they don't break stuff.
Absolutely.
But nonetheless, you seem quite critical of Microsoft in this instance. Is it really just because that time window was way too long in your view?
It's two things. Number one, the time window, that's pretty much inexcusable. Again, if it's a one-off, hey, it happens. But the other thing that's a concern to me is that almost every month they release essentially a security patch that says we're issuing kill bits on the following ActiveX. So month after month, they had a chance to issue a kill bit and to temporarily work around or at least publish an advisory and say, this is a known issue, we think it's a denial of service, here's the kill bit information, you determine if you think it's important. And then they could have upgraded that information when they figured out, hey, wait, this is much worse.
Did ISS put out an advisory that advised its customers to make use of that kill bit?
If so, it's not public. If they did share it with their customers, it didn't appear to leak. As far as most people are concerned, this is essentially a new vulnerability to the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is quite disappointing, isn't it, that information wasn't at least made public? Because, I would defend them in saying that, you know, actually issuing a patch that killed off that functionality, they would get swamped with calls and all sorts of problems because of that. But not providing their customers with at least the opportunity to set that kill bit seems just a little bit slack, doesn't it?
Yeah, to me, after, I don't know, 6 months, 9 months, a year, it seems at that point they would have said, and again, maybe they were mistakenly thinking that it was a denial of service issue, but at that point they could have easily said, hey, here's the temporary workaround, you decide. And that's where ISS could have released an advisory saying, hey, we disclosed this to Microsoft a year ago. They say it's denial of service. We believe it's code execution. You know, flag the kill bit according to what we say, and at least get some dialogue going.
Now, I believe this issue affects Windows XP and also Windows Server 2003. No word on Vista from what I can tell anyway at this stage. How widespread is the exploitation at the moment as you understand it?
from what I understand, it's bad, but it's not a, it's not really, you know, just taking out tens of thousands of computers. I'm still kind of waiting on some of the shops that do extensive monitoring to put out a report or give some statistics as to how often they've seen this.
Okay, so I guess we would just hope that Microsoft gets out a patch before this turns into the exploit du jour.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
Yeah, okay. Now, look, another thing that we wanted to touch on while we had you on the line is there's some changes happening with Millworm.
Yeah, I believe it was yesterday. Stroke announced that he is no longer going to update Millworm. It's his personal decision that it's just been taking an increasing amount of time, and he doesn't feel comfortable trying to keep up with the flood. And this is where his
Brian, let me cut you off there and just ask you to tell the listeners who might not be aware of what Millworm is, can you actually describe it for them?
Sure. It's basically a website that tracks a lot of very interesting, what many people call a zero day, but basically public exploits and vulnerabilities in software. Rather than disclosing them to the bug track mail list or full disclosure, a lot of the exploit writers decide to go through Millworm. They think that it's a better place to publish. So on any given day, you would have between, say, 5 and 15 exploits be published there, which is a considerable amount. One of the things that's really bad about Millworm shutting down is that while there's going to be a lot of people ready to step up and try to take his place, what most of the community didn't see is that Stroke actually took a lot of time in examining submissions and weeding out a lot of the exploits that were either fake, repeats, you know, from years before, or attempts to put kind of back doors on people's computer. So a lot of that time and effort and some of that specialty that he had is now gone, and I hope whoever is going to fill his shoes takes the time to do that and realizes that there's a lot more to doing or to running a site like that than just getting an exploit from the mail, slapping on the web page, and moving on.
Yeah, yeah. Look, we should mention, too, that Millworm isn't necessarily closing. It's just that the person who has been responsible for running it to date has decided that they've got better things to do than all of this work for nothing, because I understand it is a not-for-profit sort of service, isn't it?
Right. It's a complete hobby site. And his initial report is, hey, I'm going to stop updating. The website's been unavailable all day, so there's kind of rumors going back and forth whether Millworm will go away or if it may come back, because Stroke also did say that he found a group of friends that said that they would pick up where he left off and continue to run it. Just not sure if that's going to be off the same domain or a new one.
Okay. Oh, now, look, before you go, I figured you'd be a good person to ask about this. Have you heard anything about these rumors of a zero-day exploit for SSH circulating out there? Because we're hearing a lot about Red Hat Enterprise servers getting popped.
Yeah, and right now that's about all there is rumors. It's kind of interesting is that, you know, the rumor surfaced, and I believe it was SANS, their Storm Center or whatever, they got their hands on what looked to be a log of an exploit in progress that showed a lot but didn't really. You know, it was basically... Let me launch this command. Oh, look, I've got root on someone's box. Didn't show anything
technical.
Well,
they did that in the Matrix as well, didn't they, with the power plant exploit. And I don't think that actually created a genuine O-Day for Trinity to use.
Exactly. And some of the people that are claiming to be behind or to have this exploit are well known in the industry for trying to undermine the white hats and to cause grief. So whipping up these rumors of this, you know, really badass remote OpenSSH exploit that's affecting all these Red Hat servers. Yeah, it's a great way to get everyone, you know, wasting time trying to research, and there's just been nonstop mail chatter and everything. Oh, who's got proof? Who's got, you know, logs? Who's got packet captures? What do we know? So,
yeah, I mean, this is the equivalent of a Britney Spears wardrobe malfunction story. It's that equivalent in the security world, isn't it? Because it's just a bit of a time waster.
Yeah, it is. And in the long run, if I had to put money on it right now, I'd bet a dollar that there's probably not an exploit.
But would you bet $10,000?
No.
Which I guess is why it's a rumor that he's refusing to die. Brian Martin, thank you so much for joining us on Risky Business this week, and we'll speak to you again soon.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Tenable Network Security's Brian Martin there with this week's sponsor interview. And since we spoke to Brian, the consensus has shifted and seems to be that SSH bug we were talking about is just a rumor, a bit of a hoax. So that is some good news, if indeed it's true. I still personally wouldn't bet $10,000 on it, but anyway. That's it for this week's show. Thanks to all our guests. I will leave you now with this track by Unified Gecko. It's called Chilek Fasulier. And if you live in Melbourne, you can catch these guys in Brunswick at The Spot. They're doing a bit of a residency there. And I don't know what their lineup is these days, but they used to do one hell of a show. So if you like Turkish music over funk, reggae and ska beats, go check these guys out. They rule. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.
Çilek fasulye sever. 9-8 neble var. Çilek fasulye sever.